Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little boy named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Tony Reed, naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. Thanks for supporting us for the past 100 episodes. Don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also support us by visiting our Patreon page, where you can find out how you can join us for our monthly patron webinar, where we do a deeper dive discussion about all things perimenopause.
The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider. Welcome back to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast. Today I'm with Dr. Tony. We're together again. Woo woo. And we're going to revisit perimenopause just as a topic on its own. I know over the last 100 episodes, we touch on it, you know, mostly every week, but we haven't discussed it as its own subject since our first episode, Tony. Can you believe that?
That was a long time ago, Lisa.
That was a long time ago, pre-pandemic. I actually listened to it today when I was out for a walk and I was like, oh, wow, it was, you know, we shared some good information, but we want to go over again kind of what perimenopause is, what's happening in your body, and ways to assess or test for it. So this is a part one of two episodes, because in the second part, we're going to discuss treatment options. So what nutrition can help you during this transition time, what herbs, which supplements, how does HRT work or bioidentical hormone replacement therapy? But in this part one, we're going to cover all things perimenopause, what it is, what's happening, and how to test for it.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't even really realize what perimenopause is, or sometimes even what menopause is. There can be some confusion when people are using the term menopause or perimenopause. So, you know, let's just even start there. You know, what are we talking about? With, you know, menopause is really technically that time where you have not had a period for 12 months. Whereas perimenopause is kind of that transition period before you reach menopause. And it can really vary in its length. It can be anywhere from a 4-year period for some women, 8 years for other women. Some women, it can even be longer than that, even 10 years or so. And during this transition phase, that's where you can really be having a number of different symptoms, and symptoms can really fluctuate. You know, you may find that you have PMS symptoms 1 month, but not another month. You may have other kind of menopausal symptoms some months and not others. You know, during this perimenopausal transition, our hormones are really sometimes on a bit of a roller coaster, and it really is more of an unpredictable state of change and shifting. And for many women, there can be a rapid change in different health markers. There can be impacts on bone health, bone loss, the beginning stages of osteoporosis. There can be changes in weight and your metabolism. There can be change in your brain health. Really, the most common complaints that a lot of women have around perimenopause includes hot flashes, irregular menstrual cycles, changes in sleep, insomnia, fatigue, and then changes in mood like anxiety and depression. And it can be really tricky to manage those and to actually figure out, you know, what's happening. Am I in perimenopause or not?
Yeah, it is really tricky because, as you said, Toni, our hormones are all over the place, and you may be ovulating some months, other months you might not be, or you might be ovulating early. So your hormones, your estrogen can be up and down. Progesterone tends to be on the downward trend overall. We know cortisol or stress hormone can be impacted. So a lot of the symptoms Toni talked about is because of these rapidly fluctuating hormone levels. Our body is used to kind of a predictable cycle of these hormones, and that's not happening during this transition period. There are four different, if you will, stages of transitioning from premenopause to postmenopause. And this was from the Stages of Reproductive Aging Workshop. So it's called STRAW. So this is the criteria to determine which stage you're in. So stage minus three. So this is premenopausal. So late reproductive phase. So you may be getting a menstrual cycle fairly regularly, but it may be 22 to 35 days. Not everybody gets their FSH levels tested, but we know in menopause that FSH increases. So the brain starts yelling at the ovaries because you're not ovulating, you have less eggs in your ovaries, if you will. So that FSH goes up. So this part of the stage, or this stage, you have normal to variable FSH levels, and you have lower ovarian reserve. So this is people, maybe they're trying to get pregnant. They feel like they're getting fairly regular cycles, but it might be a little bit tricky. They might need a little bit of support, or it takes a little bit longer. And they're most likely getting some PMS symptoms because they're most likely ovulating more cycles than not. And then stage minus two, this is the perimenopausal phase, or we can call it early menopause transition. So this is when, for at least two cycles, your cycle length has changed 7 days or more. So either you have a shorter cycle, less than 7 days, or a longer cycle, an extra 7 days added on for at least two cycles. That FSH can be variable, and you can still have that low ovarian reserve. So you might be like, wait a minute, my period's supposed to come and it's not, or oh my gosh, it came early, it's a week early, what's happening? So this is this stage here. And then stage minus one is categorized as late menopausal transition. So you may not be getting a period. You might get a period once every 2 months. They're greater than or equal to 60 days apart. So you're noticing significant changes. If you were to get that FSH level measured in blood, that could be high, and you can have low ovarian reserve. And then once you've gone 12 months without a menstrual cycle, you're in stage plus one. So this is still called early menopause, though. So you've just reached that 12-month mark without a period. The FSH is high, and you really have low or undetectable ovarian reserve there.
And so with those different stages around, in transitioning from premenopausal to perimenopausal to menopausal, again, there are those predictable pieces of, our menstrual cycles shifting, becoming, longer apart, skipping more cycles, the follicle stimulating hormone, FSH increasing. We often will also think about with menopause how our estrogen levels will drop and decrease over time as well. And this is where it can also, again, be a little tricky. We might be saying the word tricky a lot when we're talking about perimenopause, but there's been a really interesting study called the SWAN study. That's the study of women's health across the nation, again, based in the US. So that's a study that looked at women since 1996. So it is a really long-term study. It's the kind of studies that we love to see when it comes to scientific research. But this study really have found that there is four different patterns of how women's estrogen levels can change during this transition from perimenopause into menopause, which again can be really challenging when we're looking at what's going on with each woman and how to support what's happening, or even to just to know that this transition doesn't happen the same for each woman. So it's not like it's, you know, you can really look at supporting your health with any kind of cookie cutter approach. Because, you know, there's, I'll just quickly go over the four different patterns. You know, it can be a rise and sharp drop. And that kind of common pattern is most common in women who are Caucasian. There's a rise and slow drop, which is kind of the least common pattern. There can be a really, you know, flat level of estrogen where, you know, the levels are slower and decrease lower, which is a more common pattern in African American women. And there, again, can be a slow decline where it's really slow and gradual. And that's a most common pattern in Chinese American women, Japanese American women, and Hispanic women. So again, it can be a little tricky when it comes to what kind of symptoms may happen and how you actually are experiencing, you know, this transition from perimenopause into menopause.
This is really important to recognize because a lot of people think, okay, I'm getting my period, my hormones are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And then one day, bam, I'm just not making those hormones anymore, right? My estrogen's going to drop, my progesterone's going to drop, and that's it. But we see there's all of these different stages that you can go through. And then for each person, what's happening with their estrogen can be variable as well. And it's so fascinating to think about what's actually happening in the body, right? So the more we ovulate, as the older we get, right, we have less eggs, if you will, in our ovaries. So that is a lower ovarian reserve. Hence, it's harder to get pregnant when you're older. Not only do you have less eggs, but they're of lower quality. So then what happens is the brain starts to release FSH at that higher level because it's like, hey, ovaries, release those eggs, make some eggs, grow them up. And it's not happening. So the brain starts to yell at the ovaries and that FSH number goes up. So that's one reason why the FSH increases because of the low ovarian reserve. And then there's breaks that stop that FSH from being too high all the time. Those are released as we go through, you know, perimenopause transitions as well. So what happens is your cycle gets out of sync. So you have some eggs or follicles, but they are growing faster because of that high FSH. So your body can actually, so they're lower quality and you can ovulate them earlier in your cycle. You might actually ovulate right after you get your period, when you have your period. So what's happening then is that estrogen starts to increase and you don't have this cyclical nature of estrogen. So it's kind of estrogen building on top of each other. And your progesterone tends to be kind of on the low side and it stays on the low side too. So things are happening out of sync. And then that's why you may get a shorter cycle 1 month. You might get your period and not have any symptoms. 1 month you might have PMS symptoms. So everything's basically gone haywire and nothing is unpredictable. So some months it might feel like, okay, I'm getting a regular cycle, but I'm getting PMS symptoms. Other months, it might be like, wow, I feel like I'm in menopause. I haven't had a period. It's been, you know, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, a couple of months. I'm getting night sweats and hot flashes and vaginal irritation or dryness. And then you might go back to PMS symptoms. So it's hard to have a one size fits all approach for testing and treatment because it is such a variable time.
Yeah. And especially with what you were talking about of on what that change is happening and how, you know, when you're in perimenopause, you may be ovulating for one cycle and not ovulating with another cycle. You know, there was a study of women in New Zealand where they looked at how often that will happen before you get to your final menstrual period. And that can be also a little tricky because when do you know it's your last period? Until you actually wait and look back after 12 months. So, you know, it's all about looking back to that last period. And in the years before that, they found that about 20% of women at the age of 40 in this study from New Zealand, those women were considered perimenopausal. So 20% of women when they were 40 years old. And that about 3 years before their last period, about 70% of their menstrual cycles had them ovulate about 2 years before their final menstrual period. Half of their cycles were ovulatory, or they ovulated with their menstrual cycle. And 1 year before their last period, only just a little bit over 20% of their menstrual cycles were ovulatory. So again, there really is fluctuation between cycles. So there is really variability between your periods, between your cycles, and also what kind of symptoms you can be experiencing, whether it's PMS or not having any PMS.
Yeah, so this is where it may be useful to track your basal body temperature and those ovulatory signs, right? And kind of keep a little journal related to that. And that can give you an idea of how many times are you ovulating? How many times are you not? We know the temperature goes up by 0.5 after ovulation. And then there can be the cervical mucus changes, right? So your cervical mucus, you know, there's a bit of discharge. It's more of like a raw egg white consistency. It's like sticky, you know, if it's thinner, that'll allows for the semen and sperm to enter in more easily. So some women really monitor this diligently and see, okay, did my temperature go up by 0.5? That means, you know, you just ovulated. Does the actual cervical mucus change? There's other ways to assess, but those tend to be the easiest way. So you really want to listen to your body and then track your symptoms, right? Are you getting PMS symptoms? Are you getting menopausal symptoms? I can link to, there's a really good perimenopausal diary that you can keep that you can print off, and you just rate your symptoms and if you get a flow and when that happens. So that's a really good way to keep track, because you want to know what's happening in your body. Again, it's not going to be totally predictable, but you want to get a sense of what could be happening with your hormones.
Absolutely. And also really tracking your symptoms as well. And there, again, there can be a number of different things that you may experience more frequently as you're going through perimenopause. I think probably the biggest symptom that most of us think about when it comes to menopause is hot flashes, also known as vasomotor symptoms. And again, with the SWAN study, the Study of Women's Health Across the Nation study that has been going on since 1996, they also found that there's four different patterns of these vasomotor symptoms or hot flashes in women going through perimenopause and menopause. So again, not every woman is going to experience different symptoms in menopause and perimenopause the same. And this is definitely the case when it comes to hot flashes, you know, for some women, you know, and it's almost pretty much even between the four different groups. It's not like there's a, you know, probably the most frequent pattern when it comes to hot flashes is kind of a late onset, where about 30% of women will have hot flashes near their last period. And the otherwise, it can be early onset, where some women will have hot flashes starting 10 years or more before their final menstrual period. And that really declines after menopause. There's another group of women, about a quarter of women will have high frequency hot flashes, where those start early, with them lasting up until 14 years after menopause. So again, menopause being 12 months after the last menstrual period. And then about another quarter of women will have low frequency hot flashes. So they have persistent low hot flash frequency. And again, that really kind of continues as well. So, and it's kind of tricky when looking at hot flashes, because I think until this SWAN study really looked at these patterns of how we can be experiencing our hot flashes differently, most studies on hot flashes were really on women in menopause. You know, it had been 12 months or more since their last period. But we know that, again, a lot of women in perimenopause have hot flashes as well.
I know it's shocking, right? To think you could have it for 14 years after menopause, or it could start 10 years before your last period. I really hope I'm not in those categories.
That's a lot of hot flashes.
That's a lot of hot flashes, a lot of sweating through clothes and fanning yourself and turning red. So it's real. It's real, ladies. This is a big concern, right? And then we know the hot flashes can impact so many other symptoms, right? So if you're getting hot flashes and you're not sleeping, you can have low mood. There's definitely more depression. So up to 40% of women face depression or mood changes in perimenopause. So we know this can be from the hormonal fluctuation. So as the estrogen goes up and down and up and down, the mood can go up and down. And as that progesterone tanks, that's our chill out, relaxing hormone that helps us sleep and reduce anxiety. That's going to impact your mood as well. We know if you're not sleeping, whether it's from hot flashes, whether it's from potentially low melatonin in perimenopause, there's so many factors for that. That's going to impact your mood as well. We know that as your body is changing, there can be issues with self-esteem, right? You may not be as comfortable with your partner, with yourself, and that may influence your relationships. If you go to the beach, if you have fun in a bathing suit with your kids, all of these things can add up. And we know the risk of depression is increased in this age if you've had a history of depression, if you've had postpartum depression. And how many women in this category are not only looking after kids, but looking after their aging parents, right? You could be in that sandwich generation. And then you may have challenges with your relationship if you've been focusing on your kids and your job. This is a really challenging time for women trying to juggle all the things, and it can catch up with you and lead to depression and burnout for sure.
Absolutely. And then especially if you're not sleeping well. If you're having issues with sleep, a lot of women going through perimenopause will have more insomnia. And the studies and research really varies. Anywhere from 30 to 60% of women are going to experience more insomnia through perimenopause. And that just makes everything else really more difficult. You know, you have less regulation of your hormones and less regulation of your emotions and mood and well-being as well. We've definitely talked about sleep in a couple of episodes, and we'll link to those in the show notes too. Something that I found really interesting is a study that was done last year, looking at exposure to phthalates, and that higher levels of phthalates in the pee, so what we're kind of peeing out, gives us an idea of the fact that we are exposed to higher levels. So these phthalates are hormone disruptors in plastics. That's definitely something that you talked about, Lisa, with Emma Roman in a recent episode. So we'll definitely link to that as well. So this study showed that there was a correlation between plastic exposure and self-reported insomnia. So I found that really interesting as to, okay, what are these plasticizers, these phthalates doing, disrupting our hormones and then impacting our sleep? So that's really something, to consider when we're looking at what is impacting our hormones, what is impacting how our body is managing this transition of our hormones through perimenopause and menopause.
Definitely. So we know, yes, sleep is a huge one for a lot of patients. And that's been something that I've struggled with going through perimenopause. We haven't really talked about our symptoms, so we can touch on that a bit and then get back to some of the other symptoms that you may experience. But for me, I have had a couple of cycles in the year where it's either really short or it's, I've gotten it early or it's come a little bit later. I'm fairly predictable with regularity, but insomnia and night sweats were a big concern for me. Right now, I seem to have them in check again. Again, with those fluctuating estrogen levels, we'll see, but we'll get into some treatments and what I've been doing in the next episode. But I feel like that's been more stable and I'm doing better with that. But mood changes is huge too. So right now I'm around my ovulation time, so I feel amazing. I have so much energy. I want to work out. I want to socialize. I'm feeling in a better mood, even though we're, getting into winter, even though it's the end of November, and that's not bothering me right now, but I know leading up to my period is when I start to get anxious. I feel just this low level anxiety. I may be more negative and more short with people and have less of a, you know, emotional regulation, if you will. So that's been a challenge for me. And how about you, Tony? What are you noticing with your hormones and your symptoms?
Well, especially talking about sleep, it can be so tricky to figure out, you know, what is impacting sleep, Lisa, because not only was I for the past few years, you know, managing with my daughter, Frankie, who is not the greatest sleeper. So there's that piece where you're, you know, a mom, especially when your kids are young, but even when your kids are getting older, there can be sleep disruptions with your kids. And then throw a pandemic into this whole mess that you're dealing with as a perimenopausal mama. And it's like, you know, again, all of the mood, the worry, all of those things that can impact your sleep can just be heightened. So I've really found that when the pandemic hit, that was a big impact on my sleep. And again, we'll definitely talk more about ways to get a proper sleep in, you know, our next episode. And again, you can listen back to our past sleep episode as well. But also what I've found was that I've been really working on are the hot flashes. And there are some times when they have been worse and more frequent. Thankfully, nothing to the point of like night sweats, having to change my pajamas or sheets or anything like that. Thankfully, they've been pretty much, you know, on lower intensity. But and that's really been something, especially over the pandemic, with kind of extra stress and worry that I've really had to keep on top of and find ways to manage them really effectively. And knock on wood, I'm at a really great place. And again, we can talk more about that in our next episode.
Woo-woo. I know even the cold weather can help, right? If it's a little cooler, I definitely get less hot flashes. I remember the backs of my kneecaps would sweat when I get hot flashes. I was like, I didn't know you could sweat in that area. I didn't have to wash my sheets, but I was like, oh, this is weird.
Yeah, I mean, definitely as we're going into winter, especially with, you know, a really hot summer that we had, yeah, it was something to pay attention to. But there, again, there's so many factors that can play into it, right?
Definitely. Wine, alcohol, caffeine, hot drinks, spicy. We'll get into all of that for sure. And, you know, it's amazing. We can actually get a good night's sleep with everything going on right now. So let's all pat ourselves on the back for trying to get a good sleep. I know at the beginning of the pandemic, I was waking up at like 4 a.m. and I was bing, like, I'm like, I got to do stuff. I got to like help people. I got to work. So I'm not there right now. Phew.
Oh yeah. Our nervous systems get on alert, and that's just, and it really is hard to stay in that rest and repair phase in sleep. When your body kicks into gear and is looking at, you know, survival and what it needs to do. Right.
Definitely.
Yeah. Another, again, we've already talked about how our cycles and our periods can really shift during perimenopause, and talking about how, you know, we can have some cycles where you're not ovulating, and that can actually really increase your likelihood of irregular bleeding, heavy bleeding. So, you know, sometimes, you know, you're bleeding, your flow of your period may be heavier than normal due to, you know, those reductions in estrogen. And not even just the reductions in estrogen, but also the fact that your progesterone is lower as well. So that estrogen is unopposed. And this is where really making sure that any changes in bleeding isn't due to any other issue. Again, it can be tricky to piece together all of the factors, and what's really important is not to just say, okay, my periods are a little wonky because of hormones, and just, you know, put it off as that. It really is important to look at any possible structural causes for heavy menstrual bleeding. So making sure that you're getting properly screened for fibroids, adenomyosis, hyperplasia in the uterine lining, cancer. So, you know, getting an ultrasound to really make sure that there's no issues structurally is really key. And this is where, you know, even with any kind of irregular bleeding or irregular cycles, it can also be nice to get that kind of screening if you're not having a heavy menstrual bleed. You know, this is where after having Frankie and breastfeeding for a while, of course, I wasn't having any periods while I was pumping for her. But as soon as I started pumping, I got my cycles back. I had 3 cycles in a row and I thought, okay, yeah, great. Back to regular cycles. And then nothing. And then crickets, which I wasn't necessarily too sad about. Again, kind of one of the bonuses of going through perimenopause into menopause is that we won't necessarily be having the inconvenience of having a period anymore. So I was getting just really, you know, cycles and periods that were just here and there, not very frequent at all. And I was really thankful, you know, going to see my family doctor and being sent for an ultrasound to just really make sure that there was nothing structural to be concerned about with that. So that was really great. And so I have to say, I might be closer and closer to that menopausal period where I might be close to being 12 months away from my final menstrual period. Which, again, sometimes I'm fine with, and sometimes I'm like, oh no, I'm only 45. I'm still too young. But hey, it really is about just taking it as it comes and also looking at the best way to support me. So it's nice to know that there's, again, different options to manage symptoms and to even look at supporting my health in the future.
Well, that's a great perspective to have and an attitude about it, Toni. And I think, you know, we're really going to learn from each other as we go through our transitions. We'll learn from our listeners. So we'll just share the knowledge as it comes up and share firsthand what's going on and what works. Again, you know, it's not a one size fits all, but to give you an idea of how certain treatments and changes may benefit you or may not, we can definitely cover that. So it can be a grieving period, right? It can be like, oh, this part of my life is over. But it also can be, you know, embracing the not dealing with having your period every month and hopefully not having those fluctuations and having more predictability too. And it's, you know, more of a time to go within as opposed to like focusing on reproduction. We're still going to have to care for other people because we have young kids, right? But we may have some more time and energy to focus on ourselves too.
Absolutely. And, you know, and then moving from looking at, you know, that kind of cyclical living and really being aware of your menstrual rhythms, like you were talking about, Lisa, into really the being more connected to and following the cyclical patterns of the moon cycles and really paying attention to that. So again, it's like you said, it can be a little bit of a grieving and a loss, but in a way it can be really reinvigorating and I find it really just confirming that how linked I am with nature and the universe around me as well, and still, you know, getting things done and not only being able to go inward and take care of myself, but also to take care of my family and to really use my energy to follow my purpose and what's important to me as well, to make a difference in the world.
I love that, Tony. So thank you for sharing. We know that our disease risk is greatly accelerated for certain diseases in menopause, right? So we do need estrogen. So we need it for our bones, right? It tells our bones to build and stops that breakdown of our bone. So we know osteopenia, which is the precursor to osteoporosis, your risk increases, and as does the risk of osteoporosis, and then, you know, falls and fractures and all of the things that go along with that. But we also know estrogen is protective for our cardiovascular system. So it helps keep our heart healthy, keep our blood pressure in check. Estrogen helps to keep kind of inflammation in check. If there's something called reactive oxygen species, which can damage our vessels and our tissues and cells and heart, and our estrogen helps to keep those levels in check. So as that estrogen starts to fluctuate and get lower, that does increase our risk of cardiovascular disease. It's interesting too, because if someone had PCOS, if they take bioidentical hormones or hormone replacement therapy, it doesn't change their cholesterol panel. So people with PCOS have a harder time being more preventative with high cholesterol, which we did a whole episode on that, so we'll link to that. But, you know, maybe with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes too. But women without PCOS, if they, you know, did some hormonal replacement, it kept their total cholesterol and LDL in check too. So there can be benefit using bioidentical hormones to prevent osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, even to help prevent dementia. They're starting to study this, because a lot of times we think, okay, these bioidentical hormones we just use for symptom management and then we stop, right? If you're getting the hot flashes, you're not sleeping well, you're getting the vaginal symptoms. Okay, once you've been on it for a while, okay, stop. But we're looking at being on these potentially longer term just to help keep our heart, our brain healthy, keep our bones healthy as well.
Yeah, it's, again, really interesting to look at not only different options of how you can reduce symptoms and improve the quality of your life that way, but also looking really at preventative medicine and really what makes sense to you to reduce your risk of disease, especially depending on what else is happening in your life and even your family history as well. Also, you know, your genetic predisposition can really make a difference too. So these are all things to think about as we're moving through perimenopause into menopause.
Definitely. And then another big symptom that women complain about is fatigue, right? And we've already touched on this, because if you're not sleeping, your mood's off, if you're having heavy periods, you might have lower iron levels. So there's many reasons for this fatigue. When you're feeling crappy, you're not going to exercise. You're not going to sleep as well. You're not going to eat as well. This is going to make you feel tired. But we also know, you know, if you're getting the heavier periods, you might have iron deficiency, and that'll definitely make you feel more tired. Your thyroid can be thrown off by all these hormonal fluctuations. That's going to make you exhausted or feel exhausted. So we really want to support women during this time through supporting their hormones to reduce the symptoms, but also supporting iron levels, thyroid health, sleep, et cetera.
Absolutely, definitely, Lisa. And that's where, when we kind of talk about different testing around perimenopause, something really important to look at is, you know, doing those really easy, simple screening blood tests that look at your not only your hemoglobin levels in your blood, but your circulating iron, your transferrin saturation, how saturated your iron, your blood is with iron, your iron stores, your ferritin, as well as looking at how well your thyroid is working. Especially, I mean, there's the thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH, but also your free T4, free T3, checking those thyroid antibodies like we've talked about in our thyroid episode that we'll link to. And you mentioned also, you know, we've mentioned so far in the episode about testing follicle stimulating hormone levels, or FSH hormone levels. Now, it's not necessarily like, again, diagnostic of, you know, whether you're in menopause or perimenopause or not. those levels will increase. But it, again, it is important at looking at overall what your hormone levels are. There also are some links, but when women have the higher levels of FSH, that can be linked with higher blood pressure, even something like also the TSH can be linked with also higher blood pressure, metabolic syndrome, where, you know, you have more belly fat, weight around your abdomen, and also even other markers of cardiovascular disease, like the thickness of your carotid arteries as well. So again, looking at those hormone levels are important for, you know, again, looking at what your thyroid is doing, but also they can be really a part of the whole pattern of your overall health and function as you age as well.
For sure. So yeah, looking at the FSH testing, especially if you have menopausal symptoms, even if you're younger, and there's certain times of the month, if you're still getting a cycle, we typically do it on day 3, but if your cycle is irregular, then that's not really going to matter. But that's one way to assess. And getting back to the cardiovascular disease risk, it's really interesting too. So in postmenopausal women, if that TSH, that thyroid stimulating hormone, is greater or equal than 2.5, which would be considered normal, in the reference range that the labs have, there was a link to increased carotid intima thickness. So meaning a thickness in the carotid arteries. So that can be worrisome, right? Because that can be increased blood pressure, less blood flow to the head. There may be increased risk of, you know, stroke and clots. This was even after adjusting for their total cholesterol and LDL levels. So in postmenopausal women, you want that TSH most likely under 2.5, which isn't usually the way it's treated. It's treated if you're above 4. You know, the higher the TSH, the lower or the less the thyroid is functioning appropriately, because the brain's yelling at the thyroid with that TSH if it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Yeah. So again, we really need to be looking at getting this screening blood work, but also not just being satisfied with numbers fitting in the reference range given by the lab. So many women who come to see me will say, okay, yeah, I got blood work done by my doctor and they said it's all normal and that I'm fine. And that's where, as naturopathic doctors, we are really adamant about looking at the numbers, because those lab reference ranges often, you know, don't necessarily reflect all of the pieces of health. And especially with some of this information, Lisa, around TSH, again, you can also be, you know, within the reference range and within a normal level, but still be a little bit higher than optimal and or lower than optimal. And that can have implications for your health and well-being, not only today, but also in the future as well.
Yeah, I always like to explain it. Let's stop you from falling off the cliff. Let's not wait until you actually fall off the cliff. And that could be by 1 point on a lab test and then deal with it. It's like, no, let's put that fence up so you don't fall off.
Absolutely. Something else to really consider in terms of testing is also to look at your cortisol levels. What is the output of your adrenal glands? We've definitely talked about this in previous episodes where, again, as naturopathic doctors, we tend to really like to look at more of a 4-point cortisol testing to really get a sense of what your daily rhythm is, because your cortisol levels, your output from your adrenal glands should really be higher in the morning and should drop down at night. And that's something that can be tested in the saliva, can be tested with a urinary test like the Dutch hormone testing. You can get a blood level of your cortisol your cortisol level tested through your blood in the morning. That can give some information, but again, it's not quite as robust and really comprehensive as that 4-point cortisol level to see, you know, how your stress hormones are impacting the rest of your hormones in your body.
For sure. And then it just mirrors, you know, with testing female hormones, right? It's like, okay, what test is perfect? Do I do a blood test for estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, et cetera? Do I do urine? Do I do saliva? And as you can probably deduce from what we've just spoke about, testing may provide some information, but you're not going to be the same every day. And you're getting the test done at certain time points. It's not measuring you all month or from month to month. So you can use it as a baseline or a guideline, but really we're starting to treat women more based on their signs and symptoms and really getting women to track what's going on, right? What's happening? Are they getting PMS symptoms? Are they getting hot flashes or menopausal symptoms? What's happening with their cycle? Are they tracking signs of ovulation? This can give you even more info. So it's a part of the puzzle for sure with testing, but it's not the end all be all, right? So one month it might look like your estrogen's fine, but who knows what's happening the next month or even a few weeks later. So we really have to have an individualized approach. We treat the person, not the lab results. It's still useful to get, but you need to take those results with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. It's way more important to really look at what's going on from month to month? How are you feeling? What kind of symptoms are you having? And how can we reduce those symptoms so that you're really enjoying life from day to day? And as well as really supporting your health for the future, preventing some of those diseases that we talked about that are associated with your decline in your hormones, like osteoporosis, like heart disease, and really supporting your brain health to prevent dementia as well.
For sure. Yeah. And I can just think of a few more proactive tests is getting your blood sugar levels measured. So fasting blood glucose, fasting insulin, and doing a calculation with those two. It gives you an idea if you're going to be, you know, leading into, or if you already have insulin resistance, which can be a big issue in perimenopause. That can be a whole topic in and of itself, but also your hemoglobin A1C to measure the average of your blood sugar over 3 months before the test, and even measuring a marker of inflammation called high sensitivity C-reactive protein. These can be all risk factors for cardiovascular disease, for metabolic syndrome. You want to monitor these numbers over time and then be proactive with your nutrition, with your supplementation and lifestyle to prevent them from getting worse.
Definitely, Lisa. And we'll talk more about that in the next episode that we get together for, in terms of talking about some of the research showing, you know, some of those treatments and what you can actually do when you have some of these symptoms around perimenopause and menopause.
Definitely. I think we covered what's happening in your body, what are the signs and symptoms, and everybody's going to be unique. So, you know, we're going to unpack some ways to help you transition through this time in part two. So I feel like we covered everything we wanted to talk about in that respect. What do you think, Tony?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay. So let's move on, and let's move on to the supermom moment piece of this episode. So Lisa, I know you rock it as a mom. So I know you probably have an amazing supermom moment to share with us.
Aw, thanks, Tony. Sometimes not, but you know, that's the way it goes. But we're really conscious of Stuart paying attention to traffic. Like, we walk to and from his school every day. You know, he rides his bike or his scooter when there's not snow on the ground, but he's not always great with stopping and looking for cars. And we try to reinforce it, but it can be exhausting to do every single street corner, right? This morning when I was taking him to school, I'm like, I'm going to make a game out of this. So I said, every time you see a car pulling out of the driveway that we're walking by, if you call it first, then you'll get 5 points. And every time you stop at the corner and look down the street to make sure a car isn't coming, you get another 5 points. But if you step off the sidewalk without holding my hands and without looking, you lose all your points. So I tried to make a game out of it. So I think we're going to start to do that more regularly to make him more aware, because just asking him to look doesn't always work. And, you know, we live in close to, you know, Greek Town in Toronto. It's not like we're in a suburb where there's lots of, you know, big driveways and everything spread out. No, people are driving fast. They're coming out of their driveway without looking. They're ripping around corners. So I just want to be safe with that. So that'll be my super mom moment for the week.
Amazing, Lisa. Gamification of traffic safety. I love it.
We'll see how long it lasts. Maybe he'll get sick of it by tomorrow, but hey, we're going to give it a shot.
I'm totally going to steal that from you because that was something that we were dealing with Frankie on the weekend, heading to, you know, a busier place in the city too. So I love it.
We'll share like point ideas and how to make it more engaging.
But Tony, great.
I know you're doing an awesome job, but can you think of a mess up, something that didn't quite go the way you wanted it to?
Well, sure. I mean, it's not too hard to think of those. Especially now this week we're recording before December. We're recording the last week, and I have this lovely advent calendar, made by one of Frankie's grandmas, and it's really beautiful, and it's still, you know, just 2 days until December 1st, and I have not figured out what I'm putting in the advent calendar or have all of those pieces put together. So I feel like I'm a little bit behind the eight ball, and I could have really planned that a little bit better. So just, you know, made myself a little extra stress while I knew that this advent calendar was coming. Again, I knew that December was coming. I knew that this was something that we were going to do, and I just haven't quite done it yet. So I feel like at this point, that's a mama mess up for me. I'm hoping it turns into a super mom moment. Stay tuned.
I see that as a super mom moment. You want to make the ad, like use an advent calendar and put, you know, individual toys in or things. And I made one for Stuart. So a good thing we added was Stuart's leftover Halloween candy that the Switch Witch took, and then little things of Play-Doh or stickers or crayons. So hopefully that gives you some ideas. Sometimes when they're young too, they don't remember certain toys they have. So you just put those in there. They open them and they're like, oh, wow.
Thanks for the tip, Lisa. We'll see if I can pull that off.
No problem. My pleasure. And Tony, what's your mama must have?
My mama must have for this week is, you know, just good old fashioned blocks. Frankie is at the stage where she will spend hours on an almost daily basis playing with her hand-me-down Lego blocks. So it's, you know, hours and hours of fun. She's just so creative and gets to change things up. It's really great. And again, it's really cheap. And I really find that it's really fostering her creativity. So I love seeing her playing with blocks. It's really an easy go-to, especially to minimize screen time. So blocks, Lego, wooden blocks, what have you, easy, fun toy, totally something to have on hand for kids. You never know what they're going to make out of it.
I love it. It's the simple things, right? So the Lego, just delivery boxes. It doesn't have to be fancy.
Absolutely. How about you, Lisa? What's your mama must have for this week?
Yeah, I'm going to share a recipe I came across for paleo crepes. So it's so easy to make. You just throw all the ingredients in a food processor. Stuart cracks the eggs. I add, you know, the almond flour and the tapioca flour. He measures out the almond milk, and I just blend it all up. And then you just pour them into a skillet and cook them. And it's so easy. It's not that much cleanup. And we have it every Sunday. So that's the breakfast I make for him on Sunday. So I'll share that recipe. It's unbelievably simple and really delicious.
Love it. I can't wait to see that recipe, Lisa.
we'll share it in the show notes for sure.
Perfect. And you can find the show notes at aperimenopausalmamas.com. You can also, you know, email us, connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. We love for you to subscribe, leave us a review and a 5-star rating if you enjoyed this episode. You can also support us on our Patreon page and tell your perimenopausal mama friends about us too. So thanks so much for joining us today. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.
Take care, everybody. Bye.